This is the One Thing Podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Adam Rindy. The One Thing Podcast brings together leaders in functional and naturopathic medicine to discuss actionable information that may unlock puzzles in the areas of gut health, brain health, metabolism, and longevity. Please note, these episodes do not replace the opinion of your doctor. They are not intended to diagnose or treat any condition. Please discuss this information with your provider and discuss your own unique personal health history before adapting this information. Please subscribe to our episodes so that you can stay on top of the most current information in these areas of medicine. Welcome to the next episode of the One Thing Podcast. In this episode, I welcome on Dr. Akil, the author of the new book, The Tiger Protocol, which is an integrative five-step program to treating autoimmunity. Dr. Akil is a most treasured guest. He's a Harvard-trained physician who practices integrative medicine, and he blends conventional medicine with holistic approaches, including functional medicine and Ayurveda. Dr. Akil attended Harvard University and graduated magna cum laude with a Bachelor of Arts in Biochemical Sciences. He earned his MD from the University of California, San Francisco, and completed a family medicine residency at Stanford University. He also spent time at the University of Arizona Integrative Medicine Program, where he did a fellowship with renowned doctor, Dr. Andrew Weil. And he also received a certification in mind-body medicine from Georgetown University Center. In this episode, we go through the TIGER protocol and what that means, what the acronym stands for. I think you'll find that it's very holistic and looks at some of the key drivers to autoimmunity, such as toxins and infections. And we go deeply into talking about gut health, which is obviously one of my favorite topics, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy this episode. And without further ado, I welcome you to the next episode of the One Thing Podcast. Dr. Akil, welcome to the One Thing Podcast. It's so great to have you here with me today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. It's been really a delight getting to know your background and also reading some of the books that you've written and hearing about your overall career path. I'd love for you to share with us how you have merged these backgrounds in conventional medicine, being a Harvard-trained physician, and now working within integrative medicine and also bringing in Ayurvedic medicine to your practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I came to integrative medicine first through my own illness experience, because about 25 years ago now, when I was in medical school, I developed this, at that time, mysterious illness with unexplained weight loss, severe fatigue, and chronic pain, and I was not able to use a computer or even sit upright in a chair, and I had to actually stop my medical training because conventional treatment of physical therapy and anti-inflammatory medicines wasn't really helping me. And that's when I went on a quest to explore other options and sought out Ayurveda, and that was the first thing that really made a big difference in my health after many years. And then I saw other integrative medicine practitioners, and through that approach, I really transformed my own health, and then I realized I wanted to offer this to my future patients and decided to begin that training, you know, over the next several years.
Great. And when you first started in practice till fast forward to today, how has your personal practice changed?
Yeah, I think it's really grown organically to focus on autoimmune diseases. That was not a specialty that I sought out, but just as a result of my work with autoimmune patients, and then, you know, they would spread the word to their community or colleagues and friends. And so right now I focus a lot on autoimmune patients and also patients with gut microbiome disruption and related issues.
Great. That leads me to my next question. The world of autoimmune disease, or I guess under the umbrella of rheumatologic disorders or related disorders, even autoimmune disease expands into multiple specialties. What have you seen change in the landscape of
autoimmunity, meaning the prevalence, the incidence of autoimmune disease, and then also just the way that patients are cared for over the last 25 years?
Yes, there's several things I've noticed. One is that patients are coming in younger and younger. Now, I do see children in my practice, and I had never seen, young kids less than age 7 or 8 before 20 years ago with autoimmune disease, but now they're coming in. And I think that the prevalence of autoimmune disease in both children and adults is really rising rapidly. So that's something I want to raise awareness about. And then many of the patients I do treat, I find that their autoimmune disease is a little more refractory, a little more hard to get under control. And I think perhaps for that reason, many specialists like rheumatologists or specialists that treat autoimmune disease start with more aggressive medications because, want to get the condition under control and suppress the immune system right away. And so I have seen them move towards more rapid use of more stronger medications.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And our understanding of autoimmunity has certainly changed. And I think even when I was in my medical training, it was sort of just explained as this, something happens and self attacks self. We don't really know what happens, but that's what's happening. And then, the medications are designed to, combat that effect or suppress the effect of the self-attacking self. What do we understand about it now? You allude to some things in your book, such as the bystander effect. There's also molecular mimicry. I've heard of something related to, I think it's called old friends or hygiene hypothesis. There's a lot of theories out there. Can you walk us through some of your framework of thinking about autoimmune disease?
Yes. So yeah, those are a few of the key mechanisms. So one is called molecular mimicry. And what that is basically a protein or antigen on a organism, like a microbe, bacteria, or virus that tends to mimic the structure of one of our human proteins. And so when the immune system encounters that, let's say, bacteria and makes antibodies against certain amino acids that are on the surface, then those same antibodies can cross-react with tissues that are in the body that are kind of similar. So that's the mimicry that can occur. And there's many examples, but one of the most common is with Guillain-Barré syndrome and Campylobacter, which is the bacteria that has some proteins that mimic what's found on our nerve cells. And the attack kind of affects the nerve cells as a result of that mimicry. Second is the bystander effect. And there are a couple of different versions. There's a bystander effect in psychology, but I'm talking about the one in immunology, which is more related to when the immune system attacks a pathogen, typically a virus, then there can be inflammation that damages their surrounding cells, which are just kind of in the area, unfortunately. And so the inflammation that occurs from immune attack, especially often because viruses are intracellular, then the immune system might attack that cell, and then the metabolites that are used by the immune system to attack the cell can damage surrounding cells, cause inflammation, cell damage, tissue damage as well. So those are a couple of the mechanisms we now understand in autoimmunity.
Well, that's really well described. So if I'm hearing you right, say a virus invades a cell and creates a bunch of collateral damage, and the immune system comes in to clean up that mess with immune cells. And from that, the tissues that are just happen to be there might get coded for, as far as that the immune system now recognizes them as if they were a pathogen.
Exactly.
Okay. So there's sort of a place where the mind goes when explaining this to even practitioners and patients alike, where it's like, well, what if I just go after that virus, or I go after that whatever caused the problem in the first place, say it's a metal or a virus or a toxin or what have you. If I get rid of it, does that solve the problem?
Yeah. I think that it can play a role. So, for example, the virus Epstein-Barr virus is known to be very active in patients with multiple sclerosis and lupus. And it seems that these two categories of patients have poor control of Epstein-Barr, like higher viral loads, higher, you know, titers. And so I think, you know, in those cases, when you do begin to treat those infections, get them more under control, then that should reduce one of those drivers of autoimmunity. But the thing that is important to remember is there's multiple drivers of autoimmunity. So I find it works best when there's a multi-pronged approach to address all the different drivers, but infections can be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is it still thought of in most circles that autoimmune disease is not curable and it's something that's going to be needed to be treated for life? And in rare situations, there might be a remission. Is that sort of still the general thinking? And is that something that you align with?
Yes, I think that we always have to distinguish between cure and remission. And cure is typically not possible unless this is extremely early and then only, you know, in certain cases. But I think remission is achievable for most people. And what that means is quieting of the symptoms, essentially the person feels normal, they have a good quality of life, their daily living is not affected, and they feel, it feels like a cure, but, you know, is something that is more accurately described as remission. So that's our goal, to help people achieve remission with the minimum amount of medications and the lowest dosages of those.
Great. In your book, there's a lot of emphasis on the gut. And how is that system so involved with autoimmunity?
Yes, there is a huge role that the gut plays. So we know that 70% of the immune cells are located in the gut-associated lymphoid tissue around all of the intestines. And then there's a really big role, the microbiome, which is all of those gut bacteria, you know, 40 trillion bacteria, play in regulating the immune system, in kind of educating it about how to respond, what to respond to, what not to, and how to behave properly. And then there's also a condition of increased intestinal permeability, which is commonly known as leaky gut syndrome, that has been implicated in many different autoimmune diseases as one of the earliest findings, and often before and even the full-blown disease is diagnosed, because when that increased permeability occurs, then things can enter the bloodstream from the gut that are not supposed to, like bacteria or toxins, and then circulate in the blood to other tissues, and then the immune system attacks them and causes inflammation. So that's another key mechanism that begins in the gut.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Going on to like the Tiger Protocol, how was the Tiger Protocol born? What's the origin of the Tiger Protocol? How far back did it start evolving?
Yes, I would say in the past 10 years, as I've been working with the patients, I just saw the same themes recurring over and over, that toxins were really predominant, and then the detox was very helpful for them as well. And then, you know, infections, gut health, the diet, and the role of stress as well. So I think that it just happened over time that I saw these same themes recurring, and then I wanted to come up with an acronym to capture all of them, and that's where the TIGER acronym came from.
Right. Well, I'm sure the listeners, if they haven't read your book, want to know what the TIGER acronym means. It's definitely a catchy name. And if you could just sort of walk us through the kind of breakdown of what the acronym means, and then I'd love to kind of go through talking about a little bit of the different elements.
Absolutely. Yeah. So at a high level, the acronym stands for toxins. So T is for toxins, which are low levels of environmental pollutants that we're all exposed to now in the air, water, and food. I'm not talking about obvious toxins like cigarette smoke or that kind of thing. And my whole approach is reducing exposure to toxins while simultaneously boosting your body's intrinsic detox capacity, which, you know, it does have those pathways. So the I in TIGER is infections, and this could be bacterial, virus, fungus, parasite, or other. And my approach is to really focus on making the body inhospitable to infections. So we're not trying to find the right, you know, drug for the right germ, but focusing on the environment, the terrain of the body. The G refers to gut, so that involves healing the microbiome, curing leaky gut if that is present, and helping the gut microbiome to be more diverse, because we know that's something important for long-term success in not just autoimmune disease, but overall health. The E refers to eating, so the diet. And with that, I break it up into a phase one and phase two. And phase one diet is more of an elimination diet, where you are on a more restricted gut healing focused diet. And then I talk about reintroductions, how can people expand that diet into the phase two diet, which is more of a long-term diet, not as restrictive, more diverse, and designed to boost the diversity of the microbiome. And then the R in tiger refers to rest, and this encompasses sleep and also addressing stress, because I think there's a really big role for the mind-body connection in autoimmune disease, both in the initial occurrence of it and also in driving flare-ups. So those are the five key drivers.
Great. Well, toxins is a really great place to start. Obviously, it's the first letter in the acronym, but also maybe it's one of the main drivers in this whole world of autoimmunity. You talk a lot about in the book the importance of helping the liver and helping the liver's pathways that are connected to the liver, including lymphatics. What happens when the liver is backed up with toxins? How does that affect the immune system? And also, along with that, the lymphatics. How would dysfunction in the lymphatic drainage or lymphatic pathways affect the immune system?
Yes. So starting with the liver, I think that plays a very big role in detox. And the liver packages toxins into the bile and puts them into the stool where it's supposed to be excreted with the bowel movements. And that's where it's very important to have the basics of healthy elimination, you know, making sure you're not struggling with constipation, because that's a very important avenue for detox, healthy elimination. And then we can't forget hydration. So drinking enough water, making sure that there's enough for the kidneys to function, which are also very important for detox. So I think of those as kind of fundamental that sometimes people don't forget. I mean, or do forget about those. But yeah, that's very important to set the stage for the liver to then detoxify better. And one food that I really like that supports the liver are beet greens, which are the leafy tops of the beetroot that are very rich in betaine and other unique compounds that support the glutathione production, which is one of the antioxidants in the liver, and also support methylation and general detox. So that's a great food to incorporate. And then with the lymphatic system, I think that does play a really big role, because the lymph fluid moves through our lymph nodes, which are part of our immune system. And that's one of the main ways our body does surveillance of infections. Microbes are brought to those lymph nodes and should be cleared by the lymphatic fluid to ensure healthy immune function. And if that is limited, if there's not proper movement or flow of the lymphatic tissue, then that topic of infections can come to the forefront.
Interesting. So, and in your book, you talk a little bit about how there's these different phases of detoxification and can actually get trapped in certain phases, like a phase one, where the body can maybe get a little more inflamed if there's not enough nutrients to help the body clear toxins. Can you give an example of how that might happen? Because I've always been interested in that. Jeffrey Bland talks a lot about that, you know, with Dr. Bland, with the stickiness of molecules and getting stuck in phase one. Without getting too far into the weeds with that, can you share a little bit about scenarios where that might happen?
Yeah, absolutely. So that refers to, in the liver, there's two main pathways, the phase one detox pathway and then the phase two. And phase two is actually further broken down into six different pathways. And what occurs is, in phase one, the toxin, whatever that might be, is processed by your enzymes in the liver called cytochrome P450 enzymes. And they produce an intermediate metabolite, which often can be very reactive, but it's necessary as part of the processing. And then that metabolite has to be converted or linked to some other compound for excretion. So that could be with methylation, where it's linked to methyl groups. It could be glucuronidation, where metabolite is linked to glucuronide. Sulfation, where it's linked to sulfur. So depending on which of those six additions occurs, the toxin might go down different pathways. But each of those six pathways requires its own cofactors. And that's where if you have a deficiency, let's take methylation. So if you're having a toxin that requires methylated B vitamins and you're deficient in B vitamins, then that process will be kind of blocked after that phase one metabolism occurs. And that metabolite, which is more reactive, you know, won't get shunted down through methylation. And then that metabolite itself can cause inflammation in the body.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, fasting forward to what you can do about these issues is even going back to your point a few minutes ago, you mentioned beet greens and beets in general, how nicely they support the methylation process. So, and then also in your nutritional approaches, you seem to really emphasize how to support these pathways, don't you?
Yes, I really believe, you know, food is medicine. And I think we can use food to really support many of these pathways.
Mm-hmm. And is it sort of a issue where, you know, you talk a lot about how there's the environment and then there's genetics. And so I think this is a really important point to bring up. And I'd love to hear your take on it because, you know, so many people in this world of autoimmunity, they have a hard time because people who are around them aren't experiencing the same symptoms as they are, you know, family members or friends, roommates, and they might be living in an environment that's really bothering them, but their roommate doesn't have the same problem. Can you talk about the genetic component of all this and how certain people are set up to be more environmentally sensitive or affected by toxicant loads?
Yes, there's definitely a significant difference. And certain people are a lot more able to process toxins and handle them well. So for example, glutathione levels are important and really make a big difference in processing a wide variety of toxins. So if a person is depleted in glutathione, they're going to be a lot more sensitive. And there are also genetic polymorphisms, like single nucleotide polymorphisms in a variety of pathways, like methylation and all these other detox pathways that impact the ability to detox. And that's why, for example, certain patients are very prone to mold exposure from water-damaged buildings, whereas others are completely unaffected and they don't have the same genetic predisposition to be struggling to clear those toxins. So I definitely think that the genetics plays an important role there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving into infections, this is an interesting topic, and a number of functional medicine patients or functional medicine providers will encounter these panels where a number of viruses are looked at or bacteria, and there's a whole emphasis on trying to remove any signs of a pathogen or potential pathogen from the body. You made a comment earlier, and I would love to kind of start off our conversation with this about how to make the body less hospitable to infections, and that's kind of your emphasis versus like, let's just find a bug and kill it. So can you share more about that?
Yes, absolutely. And this is actually a key Ayurvedic principle, is that the terrain of the body, the inner environment, makes a really big difference in terms of whether or not a person is susceptible to infections. So I think we sometimes don't give that enough credit and focus too much on the bug, like you mentioned. And so with my approach, one of the things that makes the body inhospitable to infections is optimizing the intestinal pH, because it's been shown that the large intestinal pH, which can be measured as a stool pH, is a very important barometer for the balance of microbes. And many potential pathogens like candida and certain opportunistic bacteria can only overgrow if the pH goes out of range and becomes more alkaline, like above 7.5. Below those levels, like at healthy pH levels of 6.5 and lower, the growth of all those pathogens is inhibited. And so I think that's one example where your environment, the intestinal pH, has a really big impact on organism growth or, you know, the lack of growth.
Okay. And you feel we have influence over that or have ability to impact that?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest driver of intestinal pH are short chain fatty acids, which are supposed to be produced by the gut bacteria when they process fiber. And so studies have shown, there was one study where patients doubled their fiber intake from 17 grams a day up to 34 grams per day. And in just 2 weeks, there was a significant drop in their stool pH as their bodies, you know, started to produce more of those short chain fatty acids. So when you change your diet, those changes can impact the stool pH pretty rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just amazing how much we can do with understanding fiber and prebiotics and resistant starches. And you spend a lot of time talking about that in your book. Since you have written your book, has anything added to your excitement about what we can, how we can improve our health with these compounds and these aspects of our diet?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, since I've published the book and been talking to a lot of people, I realized that there's a lot more awareness about fermented foods, which is great because we know research shows increasing fermented food intake lowers inflammation and also probably quiets autoimmune activity, but there's less awareness about prebiotic foods. And so I think those are really valuable, like the foods that contain resistant starch or polyphenols or inulin. And some of those foods might be surprising to people. Like, for example, chestnuts are one of the best sources of polyphenols when it comes to nuts. And when we're looking at polyphenols in spices, clove powder is actually the richest source of polyphenols. And so adding some of these simple foods can really make a big difference in the microbiome.
Yeah. And you even talk about a certain Ayurvedic herb in the book that you can use to season meats or with, and that's actually a fairly well documented approach to preventing bringing infections or microbes that are pathogenic into your gut. Can you talk about, is that a traditional practice or is that something that's more modern?
Definitely a traditional practice. Yeah. And before the advent of refrigeration, you know, spices were used in India to preserve foods. And so there's a real understanding of what spices have that antimicrobial effect. And they are, you know, still able to have that effect now. So when we add them to our cooking and use them in our foods, they have a really powerful effect.
That's great. So we have to be spicy.
Yes, exactly. Right.
And I think, you know, the variety of spices that you can use in cooking is just phenomenal. I mean, all different types of ways you can incorporate spices and, you know, throwing them into marinades and dressings and, you know, just is a way of making your diet more medicinal. So I was really pleased to see that you mentioned that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of spices. Yes.
And I know there's, I think in the last couple of years, there's been a lot coming out about probiotic food, meaning like ferments. And you do spend a great deal talking about ferments in your book. And what I always have an issue with is just because we see people who aren't doing well is a lot of people can't tolerate them out of the gates. What do you say to that?
Yes, that does happen. I think one strategy to get around that is starting with a very low dose. So I've had patients that could not tolerate actual sauerkraut, but they could tolerate the sauerkraut juice and started with like 1 teaspoon of that per day. And then over time, you know, up to a tablespoon of sauerkraut juice, and then started to tolerate like a few strands per day, and then gradually started having more sauerkraut. So sometimes it can take many months for the body to adjust, and being patient is really helpful there, just starting very low and increasing the dose gradually.
That makes sense. Yeah. So we've already talked a little bit about the gut, but I'd love to kind of highlight a few things that you talked about in your book. I think the intestinal pH is such an interesting concept, especially when you think about it through the lens of what can grow in certain pHs. The other thing that I'd love to hear about is you really highlight a few probiotic species that you like to see be well represented in the gut. One of them is getting a lot of news these days called Akkermansia muciniphila.
Yes.
Maybe we could talk about that one because I think, you know, some of the other probiotics have a lot of discussion already established, but that one's really coming on the scene. Why is that so important as being a keystone species in the gut?
Yes. Akkermansia has good research now indicating it plays a major role in regulating blood sugar, regulating metabolism, and also weight. So the people who had the highest levels of Akkermansia were the most likely to lose weight in various, you know, calorie restriction programs. So basically, having a healthy Akkermansia ensures that you can lose weight if you want to. And I think the good thing is that even though there are now probiotics which contain Akkermansia on the market that have that species, using food is a pretty reliable way to raise the levels. And that's what I've seen in my patients, specifically the red polyphenol rich foods. So things like cranberry and pomegranate and dragon fruit and their juices. And then also there's red rice and red quinoa for people who don't want to have, you know, too much fruit. And those red polyphenols are very powerful at raising levels of acromantia. So when I do follow-up stool testing, often I see that if a patient that has started those red polyphenol foods, their acromantia levels have gone way up. So I think it's very important to use diet to support acromantia.
Yeah. I've also heard that acromantia, since it can feed on mucus, one of the effects it has on the body is that by munching on the epithelial layer, kind of the mucus that surrounds the, it stimulates the body to make more mucus. And that's...
Yes, exactly.
That's probably a good thing, right?
Yes, that's always kind of a question mark that people have about acromantia is if it's consuming mucus, is it going to be thinning the mucus layer and promoting leaky gut? And the answer is, you know, is likely not, because research shows that the net effect of that consuming of mucus is actually remodeling of the layer and increasing production by goblet cells of more mucus. And so increased thickness of the mucus lining in the end is the result, and in both animal and human studies. So I think, yeah, acromantia definitely supports gut permeability.
Okay. Now I always like to think about what's the end game with all of this stuff that we're talking about the gut. You know, so there's helping prevent intestinal permeability, and which decreases inflammation. And then there's this other component, which is the postbiotic effect, which you sort of talked a little bit about. But you talk a lot about butyrate and some of the other postbiotics. Why should we care about postbiotics?
Yes, I think these metabolites like short chain fatty acids such as butyrate and acetate are very powerful anti-inflammatories. You know, they really regulate inflammation in the gut and also systemically. Plus, butyrate has been shown to help brain health and even help heal leaky brain, which is impaired blood-brain barrier. So just like you have leaky gut, and with the gut lining, you can have impaired brain. And they've actually seen that on imaging studies now of the leaky brain. But butyrate helps with that. And in addition, it's the primary fuel for a lot of the intestinal cells. So that's very important to keep them nourished. And yeah, the effects on the immune system and inflammation are very profound.
Excellent. And I think touching upon a few other aspects going further into the protocol would be great. I know you've been so gracious with your time. I'd love to just kind of talk about a few more aspects. So going into the components of environment, what are some concepts that we need to be thinking about that actually impact the immune system more than others?
Yes, I definitely think, you know, the environment is key. And I think of both the inner and the outer environment. So with outer environment, the toxins, you know, which we've spoken about, reducing exposure and trying to boost detox. I'm a big fan of the sauna therapy for that reason, because research shows that sweating in a sauna is actually much better than sweating from exercise at detox and excreting toxins through the sweat. So whether it's a steam sauna, infrared, that doesn't matter, but I'm a big fan of those. And then I think when it comes to the inner environment, the role of stress is really important, because we know all of these factors are connected. So stress directly causes intestinal permeability to be increased and causes a disruption of the gut bacteria. And through affecting our sympathetic nervous system and our hormones, you know, promotes inflammation. And so that's why in research, the strategies that relieve stress, whether it be meditation or psychotherapy or gratitude practices or prayer, you know, all have been shown to help quiet autoimmune disease and help with bringing people into remission.
Mm. That's great. There's a comment you make in your book about the effect of sauna. I was sort of blown away by how much it can do to reverse morbidity or mortality, even actually not mortality, but the onset of certain diseases. That's fascinating. You talk a little bit about the science behind that. What do you think about as far as sauna as a therapy, as a lifestyle choice? Is it something that's just top of the list in your treatment recommendations?
Yes, I think both heat exposure and cold exposure have a lot of benefits, you know, in terms of reducing inflammation and helping support heart health, having that cardiovascular benefit and also hormonal benefit, brain benefit. So yeah, sauna is kind of my favorite therapy for heat exposure that I recommend. And then incorporating some like cold showers or a cold plunge to get some cold exposure, not necessarily on the same day, but in addition, as part of your regimen, I think that's a very powerful combination.
Great. So finally, getting into the rest component, I think there's a point in some of your comments that you talk about heart rate variability. And can you talk about how when our system is stressed, it affects flare-ups? Why is that? I also think you talk a little bit about cell danger response. I wonder if you could just share a little bit about those, because a lot of people are really interested in, you know, how they can watch their heart rate variability and get on top of their stress before it actually manifests as a physical problem.
Yes. So heart rate variability is a great barometer for kind of the set point of the nervous system, because as you get more sympathetic activation and the fight or flight response, there's a drop in heart rate variability. And when you get the parasympathetic activation, which helps counteract stress, then you raise heart rate variability. So many different autoimmune conditions have shown that those people in those cases where they have that condition have lower rates of heart rate variability. And so tracking and strategies to help with raising heart rate variability, most mind-body techniques, as well as exercise, are really good ways to boost that. And it's a metric that you can easily track, you know, with your phone or your Apple Watch. And it's another useful metric that I think people can look at. And then, yes, the cell danger response, I think, is very fascinating in terms of understanding the mechanisms of how a lot of these insults that we've been talking about, like toxins and infections, bacteria, how they translate into the inflammation in the end. And I think one of the key drivers of the cell danger response are mitochondria, because we know that mitochondria play a big role in energy production, but there's so much more than that. You know, they really are involved in the cell danger response. So when there are infections that the cell is dealing with, mitochondria produce certain proteins that then affect other cells. They're secreted in the blood and impact the immune system. So mitochondria are also very tuned in to inflammation in the body and, you know, the health of multiple systems in the body besides just energy production. So I think it's important to recognize that.
Great. Thank you so much. And I'm sure people are wondering out there, especially people who are not feeling well, is if, you know, if they were to follow this process and the nutrition and the kind of exploration of these different elements, do they have to start in this order? Do they have to do it all? Is there kind of different entry points to the Tiger protocol? Is it, you know, always the same for everybody?
No, I think the good thing is that there are choices, because these five kind of drivers of autoimmunity that are in the Tiger protocol, you know, are all important. And so if a person is more drawn to start with one versus the other, that's totally fine. And you don't have to do everything all at once. I think that picking something that is more bite-sized, more doable, and starting with that, always starting slow whenever you're making any type of changes, all those things can help with that process.
Excellent. So some closing thoughts, I would love to hear some, like a take-home message for you to share, if you don't mind sharing with us. And then anything that you'd like to share with the listeners about how they can follow your work, or anything that you're wanting to let us know about that you're working on, or how we can support you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one comment that I always like to mention is the importance of mindset in healing, because I think believing that you can feel better and that your patients can get better is very important. And I've had many patients tell me that I'm the first doctor that's told them that they could feel better, because in medicine, we are very tuned into, you know, their statistics and sometimes emphasizing that a disease is incurable or lifelong, and that can convey a negative message to the patient, and they don't hear that, you know, they can still symptomatically improve and have a better quality of life. So I think having that mindset where you believe you can feel better is very important in starting the process. So I think that should not be ignored. And, you know, there's research that many of these changes can have rapid effects. So like we talked about how changing the fiber in the diet in just 2 weeks can change your stool pH. And then there's also studies showing that removing toxins, like switching to a more organic diet, can lower pesticide levels in the urine by 80% in just 7 days. So these steps can have pretty rapid change in those root causes. And yeah, so for people who want to find out more about my work, my website, drakil.com, which is drakil.com, is the best place to start. And I have also created some online courses, which are accessible through the website, especially more focused on Ayurveda and different conditions, going more into various autoimmune conditions. So that's also an option in addition to the Tiger Protocol book.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Akil. This has been wonderful. And I look forward to having my patients pick up your book and, you know, and using the information, because the first half of the book is a lot of the background and philosophy and structure. And then the last half of the book is very actionable and practical and gives people lots of really good resources. So congratulations. Really happy you put the book out in the world.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Rinda. Thanks for having me on the podcast. And I appreciate the opportunity to share about the book today.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of the One Thing Podcast. Please share these episodes with your friends, loved ones, colleagues, patients, healthcare providers, anyone who you feel might benefit from hearing these informative interviews. We tend to learn best from people sharing things with us. That's often the first time it's introduced. So don't hesitate if the content of these episodes reminded you of someone that might benefit, forward the episode to them, and I'm sure they'll either appreciate it or be appreciative that you've thought of them. So once again, we'll look forward to seeing you next episode on the One Thing Podcast. And again, much appreciation for you being here with me. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of the One Thing Podcast. Please share these episodes with your friends, loved ones, colleagues, patients, healthcare providers, anyone who you feel might benefit from hearing these informative interviews. We tend to learn best from people sharing things with us. That's often the first time it's introduced. So don't hesitate if the content of these episodes reminded you of someone that might benefit from it. Forward the episode to them, and I'm sure they'll either appreciate it or be appreciative that you've thought of them. So once again, we'll look forward to seeing you next episode on the One Thing Podcast. And again, much appreciation for you being here with me.